Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the first of our Empire Podcast spoiler specials for 2013. Today I'm joined by James Dyer.
Hello.
Ali Plum.
Hi.
And Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And on today's show we'll be talking about the first blockbuster of the summer, Marvel's Iron Man 3. And when I say we'll be talking about it, I mean we'll be talking about everything. From the off, we'll be delving into the many twists, turns, reveals, surprises and genuine shocks of a movie that is gloriously unpredictable and very entertaining. And that's not all. Later in the show, Helen and Ali will be sitting down with Iron Man 3 director Shane Black and his co-writer Drew Pearce to get the skinny on why they did what they did, when they did, to whom they did and how they did it. So, if you haven't seen Iron Man 3, stop listening now.
Have they gone?
They've gone.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure they've gone. Oh, wait, I didn't tell them to come back after they've seen it.
Never mind.
Damn it. Thank you for staying with us. And now it is time to talk about the ins and outs of Iron Man 3. A film, it has been, I wrote Empire's cover feature for.
Yeah.
And but still was in the dark about an awful lot of this movie. And I love that, actually. Mm. I love the fact that this movie had the power to genuinely surprise me.
And having seen about 10 bajillion trailers, TV spots, posters and everything else, even though some of those 10 bajillion featured scenes from very, very late in the movie, didn't actually feel any the wiser. And there were still loads of surprises when you went in, which is impressive.
Absolutely. So where should we start? Someone threw something out.
Extremis.
Extremis.
Let's start with Extremis.
Okay.
Now, this is a Warren Ellis storyline, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the Warren Ellis, Adi Granoff 6-issue arc from a few years ago.
Was it 2005, 2006?
It was an influence on the first Iron Man movie, so it was really around about that.
It's pre-House of M, and it's post, as I understand it, the Avengers disassembled storyline, which ties in quite nicely to following the Avengers film.
That is correct. It's a really good arc, actually, if you can pick it up. It's available as a graphic novel. It's available in Comixology, if that is your thing. And it's fantastic. It actually influenced, in terms of the design and tone of the movie, the first Iron Man movie, and all the subsequent
films. Indeed, because it has a revised sort of origin tale for Stark in it, doesn't it? Which is what plays into the first
beginning. It does, yes.
Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, that kind of thing.
It does. And the Extremis comic book, I mean, it's a very different take on the Extremis. If you're a fan of Extremis, which we think now is definitively pronounced Extremis, because I've heard Extremis. It is Extremis. If you're a fan of the comic book and you think you know the comic book will be replicated in the movie, it is not, as we now know.
No, indeed.
It is not. The chief scientist in the comic book is Maya Hansen. He's an old flame of Tony's. That's fairly faithful. She's involved in the weaponization of Extremis. She's got her fingers slightly dirty. Again, that's true in the movie. But Aldrich Killian, for example, is completely different. He is the co-creator of Extremis in the comic book, although less so than Maya Hansen. As the comic book begins, he's dead. They've released Extremis, which is a majorly dangerous weapon, and he is overcome with guilt about it, and he commits suicide. And he's very much a footnote in the comic books. Here, though, he is, as played by Guy Pearce,
he's the big
chief
bad
villain. He is the big bad. Yeah. He is, as he says at the end of the movie, "I am the Mandarin." It's not Ben Kingsley.
It's not Trevor.
It's not Trevor. One of the great reveals of the year. I'm gonna say. So, what were our thoughts in this on first of all the treatment of Extremis in this movie and the revelation of Aldrich Killian?
I haven't read Extremis, but I've read around it. I gather that Extremis isn't quite what it is in this film. It isn't the super regenerative, my limbs come back.
It's. I think my understanding is it's regenerative, but it's speed, it's strength, and then there's other factors. Like when Tony infects himself with it, he gets super IT powers, you know, which everyone can do with.
Yeah, it's rewiring the human brain, isn't it? So therefore your body, your entire nervous system is souped up to its absolute nth degree. So it means that, I guess it's the ultimate super soldier program in many, many ways.
Mm. But with this Extremis, it seems to, if we just get it down to its bare bones, into the kind of 12-year-olds round the schoolyard type description, it allows you to create a large amount of energy out of your hands, and at one point with Guy Pearce, out of your mouth in a kind of breathing fire move. It's a heat-based energy power.
Yeah. It's an energy-based system.
Yeah, because they regenerate, don't they? But it manifests itself as heat.
Yeah, but massive amounts thereof. I have to say I had a little bit of trouble with this. For some reason, I was kind of okay with the regenerative thing causing people to explode, which happens early, obviously, in the movie with the plant and everything else. That, for some reason, I was like, all right, fine. Yeah, it goes crazy and your cells go crazy and then boom. I had more trouble with it being controllable. And that did take me out of the film for a good sort of 10, 15 minutes. And then I kind of just...
Really? I don't quite get that.
Listen, I love the film, but I did have a bit of problem with, okay, so you're able to heat your hand hot enough to melt the metal of, you know, the water tower for one, and still be fine, and that's not burning you. I mean, there was one shot, I have to say, I think this is a tiny blooper, where Killian does that and still has his watch on, which seems unlikely. But, I mean, these are nitpicks.
Of Advanced Idea Mechanics. He could have an indestructible watch.
Fine.
It's adamantium watch.
It could be an adamantium watch. I don't know, I quite like that. I mean, the idea is obvious that there are certain people for whom Extremis is just like breathing. Yeah. And they just take it like a duck on water. And Aldrich Killian is clearly one of those people. Yep. So is his sidekick, which I love this guy, James Badgedale, as Savine, the evil sidekick, who's codenamed, I think, in the comic books Cold Blood, but it's not referred to that by that name in this movie at all. And they just, they're badasses with it, and they can control it, and I didn't have any problem with that. I mean, and there are people who can't, hence James Tigard at the beginning of the movie, who explodes.
I really like the way it was used as a superpower. It was just one of those things that was a bit of a big ask for, I think, for an audience to swallow, just momentarily. And I got back into it and I continued to love the movie. But it was like, wow.
Are you okay?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks so much for asking.
Are we still an effective team?
Have we ever been?
No.
No.
I still like the idea of it being a power where Iron Man could try to punch someone with Extremis, and the guy with Extremis, as this kind of super soldier built up, you know, hyper best top human level person, could grab the hand of Iron Man, and it's a conceivable thing.
Yeah. It was a real threat, which
was a real
very
threat,
good. Yeah.
Which we have found previously.
Yeah.
It's been, you know, metal men hitting each other and or a bigger metal man hitting another smaller metal man. This one I actually felt like there was gravity and danger.
But it seemed to have a sort of an EMP effect as well, didn't it? Because it paralysed him on the plane, and also with War Machine, she basically grabs his hand and paralyses him with the, you know, heat.
She locks him into his armour as well.
And he can't move,
way.
Which is... Yeah, I'm not quite sure how that happened.
Which is interesting.
They just overload the circuits?
Maybe it's the IT powers we talked about.
It's super IT powers.
Super tech support.
Super Faris.
So how does Extremis connect with... when I first read about Extremis, thought that Extremis was the ability to bring parts of the suit
to you. But that's interesting, isn't it? Because in the comic, that is part of it, that he is able to bond with the suit on that level.
Yeah.
And that makes its way into the film, but it's not Extremis. It's these implants that he essentially puts into
himself. Kevin Feige and Shane Black in the Empire feature told me that that's what they didn't want to do. They wanted to avoid that. And so it was a bit of a red herring initially whenever we first saw the Comic-Con footage last year of Tony bringing the armour to himself. That's the Mark 42 prehensile suit, which... he has implanted something in his body, which controls the suit from doing kung fu moves, a funky remote control within his wrist, if you will. And that's really, really cool, and I really like that. And I like the idea that Tony's a kind of fighting a war with himself in this one. The identity, am I Tony Stark or am I Iron Man? And again, in the end, he settles on being both ultimately. But the Extremis stuff. I mean, Feige and Black did not want that repetition, as you say, of Iron Man just punching another metal man for 2 hours. And I really, really liked that. I liked the fact that the Extremis guys were a threat. There's a moment towards the end where Rhodey is facing two or three of these guys at once, and you're genuinely going, I don't know how he's going to get out of this, because he's just a human guy with a gun. How is he going to get out of it? And he does in a very, 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 very cool way.
MacGyver's his way out of it.
Yeah, he does.
You might be a little annoyed that I'm jumping very, very far into the very end, but I'd like to ask about how Extremis, whilst we're talking about Extremis, will affect the next films in terms of Pepper Potts surviving and being, in my mind, the last person alive who has Extremis.
Well, there was a line in there about healing her, which I kind of interpreted as very, very swiftly extracting all that and turning it back to normal.
I think that's what they did.
Is that what they're doing? Because part of me was hoping that, you know, next time Pepper Potts is put into danger, and I bet she will be, she could just flame on and deck a load of other metal
and get extremely violent.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think there's a line at the end about not only does Tony have a clean slate with himself, he removes the shrapnel from his heart at long, long last. Why didn't you do that 10 years ago? Maybe technology hadn't caught up with it. Who knows?
Chinese doctors are good, I hear.
He destroys his suits, pretty much all of them, in the clean slate. And he does the same with Pepper. It's a bit of a reset button at the same time as Helen. I know you're big in this, the growth of Tony Stark at the end of the movie, which is interesting to see.
Yeah, I have a bit of a pet hate for superheroes, both in comics and movies, who never really go forward. And I feel like we should move these stories forward and we should be adults about it and not demand that, you know, Spider-Man stay at, you know, at university for his entire life, you know. And in the comics they've done that over the years. They've moved him forward, they've given him wife, kids, whatever. I feel like, and then they would kind of reset these comic book stories because they're worried they're getting too far away from their fan base. But I think it's a good thing. I think we should, you know, grow these characters. We should let them change, especially on screen where it's a much, you know, more spread out kind of medium. They're not happening every week. They're happening every 4 years or something. I think it's great to actually see characters be allowed to change. If you have a big problem in your life, you should be allowed to get over it. Batman at some point should get past the parents thing. You're a grown man, come on, you know. And I feel like I'm always very welcoming when I see at least signs, at least glimmers, that a character is genuinely changing and genuinely growing. He's still going to be Tony Stark, he's still going to be sarcastic, he's still going to be combative, probably irresponsible, certainly flamboyant. But, you know, he could be a slightly different Tony Stark, and I think that's great.
As he says to Pepper at the end of the movie, everything will never be okay with me.
Yeah.
You know, she goes, will everything be okay? I'm Tony Stark, everything will never be okay.
Yeah, you're in a relationship with me, it's never going to be okay.
Yeah.
I've always loved the relationship between Pepper and Tony, and there were glimpses of just how great it could be in Iron Man 3 in Avengers. The way they spoke at the top of Stark Tower, I was like, this is brilliant. I would love to be the guy or one of the people who gets asked around to their dinner parties. And I really felt that their relationship was real. I felt like, you know, of course this is all fantasy, but I felt like the way they kind of hate and love each other, he's a nightmare to live with, but, you know, it's the real deal. He buys her a massive giant bunny.
Worst present ever.
I felt it, and hats off to Shane Black, I guess, but also obviously the actors involved, for making me totally believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. I really love their relationship, and I hope that, because they've both now come to the end of their contracts, and I really hope that they both sign on for more. I wouldn't like to see Tony in particular. I wouldn't like to see Tony being recast ever. I can't see how Marvel would.
You couldn't do it. As I said, we were talking about this earlier. He inhabits that role entirely.
I do wonder if, you know, if podcasts and the internet had existed towards the end of the '60s, we'd be having the same conversations. Like, you know, Connery is Bond, man. He is Bond. I don't know if we can recast James Bond. I mean, he's made it his own.
But I mean, dial it back. Can you imagine if they'd cast anyone but Downey in that role, whether anyone else could have pulled it off to that extent? Because one of the talents he has, he makes Tony so incredibly likable. He's so funny, he's so appealing, that unlike a lot of them where, you know, you want to see Spider-Man, Peter Parker, although Andrew Garfield did do a good job of that, you not to bother about Peter, with this Tony Stark is more appealing than Iron Man more often than not.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a rare feat, and I think that's all Downey,
to the point where this movie, I mean, it's mainly Tony.
Yeah.
And it goes to great lengths to keep him out of the armor, which I really, really, really loved. Even down to the boot and glove sequence, even the Air Force One sequence, he's not actually in the armor, which is a lovely reveal.
Yes.
And then there's, but I also love the fact that at the end that he does need the armor as much as he can function without it. He does need it, and that great sequence with the 40 suits at the end, jumping from suit to suit, I thought
was absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Both Iron Man movies to date have suffered from a weak third act, and this movie went kind of the other way. It's like not a weak first act, but certainly
a slower first act,
setting up all the pieces and putting them into place, and then once it takes off with the attack on 10880 Malibu Point, which doesn't exist. I googled it. Such
you
a shame.
Had to google
I had to google it just in case, you never know. He even gives a zip code. Once that happens, it really, really does take off. And watching Tony being ingenious and MacGyver his way out of situations, as Ali said, is fantastic, and relying on that intellect of his, which is great.
We wanted to concentrate on surprises to begin with. We were very surprised by certain parts of the film. I like to think been resident, oh my god, there's something about Iron Man Online guy for Empire Online, and yeah, I totally didn't see Tony popping his way out of the box.
He's in the film.
Tony Slattery.
Oh, Tony Slattery. That would have been amazing.
Sorry, no, that would have... I totally had a whose line is it anyway brain fart there. But I'm talking about Trevor Slattery. He was a total I didn't see coming moment, and I was in hoots of laughter.
Yeah, same here.
I was in a screening room where there were a bunch of people who obviously weren't anywhere near as excited as I was. And when he started doing his, everybody calm down thing, I was wailing with laughter.
An out of work actor with digestive issues.
He's the toast of Croydon.
He's genius. That was the toast of Croydon. That's another interesting point. Some of the lines in this are absolute gold.
Really
and
funny.
Iron Man, I think, has always been on the funnier side of the superhero spectrum, but this in particular, you know, it's very Shane Black. It's also, as you say, a lot of credit has to go to
well,
Drew Pearce.
You know, Drew Pearce, his name comes first in the screenplay, and I think there's a reason for that. He was first on the movie. He was on before Shane Black was brought on, and I know Kevin Feige. It's a complete leap of faith from Kevin Feige that Shane Black, one of the greatest screenwriters in Hollywood, would somehow get on with this Brit, and they have like a house on fire to the point where I think they might be writing another one or two movies together. And it's just,
I can't wait.
It's wonderful to see the mesh of sensibilities, and Shane Black's a big fan of British comedy and Monty Python and whatnot, and that does come across.
And in the same way that it was lovely seeing and very surprising seeing Ben Kingsley play an utter psycho back in Sexy Beast, it's kind of surprising to see him play an utter stoner basically in this one. You know, it's just completely subverting your expectations but doing it really, really
but it's
cleverly.
The violent tone shifts that just work so the juxtaposition of the comedy and the drama. It's like when we talk about the excellently choreographed fight against Tony with Tony and the goons when he's got one glove and one boot, which is really well put together, and he's fighting them, and then you have that gag at the end with the last henchman which just lands so perfectly, and I think that sums up really for me what works about that film.
Drew Pearce described it to me as zigzagging. Every scene zigzags, so it starts off as one thing and ends as another thing, and that replicates the way Tony's brain works.
And you can never catch your breath either.
It's just, I think, sums up why I think we love Tony Stark as a character, because he is so unpredictable. And this movie for the first time in the Iron Man franchise is a reflection of that.
I think that is one of the lines of the film, is a guy who we see for 2 seconds then runs out. Honestly, I hate working here. They are so weird.
And he puts down his gun and leaves.
You're just a guy getting
hired
to kill
by Iron Man.
You've watched all your friends being killed horribly, and you put the gun down.
It's the most sympathetic treatment of henchmen since Austin Powers.
It is, and it's a lovely thing, because you would have thought Austin Powers might have exhausted all the henchmen giving up sort of jokes, but this really does it. But back to Trevor, back to the Mandarin.
Back to Trevor.
Because I love this on so many levels. One is that, this was just me, I don't know whether you guys felt the same, but there was an element for me, as Trevor was doing his thing, explaining to Tony that he's just an actor who's been employed to pretend to be the Mandarin, there was part of me going, is this a trick by the Mandarin? Is he actually the Mandarin now pretending to try and be an actor so Tony will believe him?
That's an interesting point, because it's such a great bait switch, because the Mandarin is an Iron Man nemesis. I mean, he's a nemesis, essentially. He's a super evil genius with alien magic rings.
He is the Iron Man nemesis,
indeed.
I would say.
And to have him essentially be entirely fictitious in this is a stroke of genius.
Yeah, and I love that Marvel are doing this, and I love that Kevin Feige's had the stones to do this, because what they're essentially saying is that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is now essentially completely its own thing, and the comics are fine, and we will take things from the comics, but if something doesn't fit our world, we will change it completely, and we will pay it scant respect if it deserves scant respect. And frankly, the Mandarin is, and was, I guess, not probably no longer, but was the Iron Man nemesis for the first 20, 30 years of Iron Man's career. It is also, frankly, a dodgy character is ever so slightly racist, and I know they've been struggling. They were talking about the Mandarin in Iron Man 1 being the bad guy right up until the last minute, and they ditched him. They were talking about elements of the Mandarin being in Iron Man 2, and again they just couldn't reconcile this character. They couldn't reconcile this Fu Manchu, as Feige says, treatment of the character in the comic books with what they wanted to do on screen. And what they've hit upon, and I think this is mainly Drew Pearce's idea, as you guys will hopefully find out in the interview, and what they've done is they've completely undermined and subverted the character and made it as ridiculous as it is in the comic books, and I love that.
I wouldn't go there for 20 minutes.
Which was genius. The accent, though, the accent that he puts on, I'm still not sure what it is. You'll never see me coming. Sounds a little bit like Stephen Hawking, but you know.
What? It's true. There's a little bit of a kind of an automated vocoder.
Yeah.
It's
sort of the extending R's. But that's made all the more enjoyable by the fact that that Trevor's essentially making it up as he goes along.
Yeah. One question, though, and I'm going to get you guys to ask Drew and Shane this. Why is he a Liverpool fan? Why do they have to make the world's most evil man, even if he is a shadow puppet at that point? Why is he a Liverpool fan? That's a Liverpool... Al, you think it's a Liverpool-Chelsea game. It's definitely Liverpool.
But that's a Kingsley thing, though, isn't it?
It's a Kingsley addition, yeah.
But is Kingsley a Liverpool fan?
I doubt it.
I thought he was from Manchester, isn't he?
Oh, that's a makes no difference, does it really?
I doubt it, but do find out.
Yeah,
do find out.
I've scrawled in my notebook, Liverpool versus Chelsea.
It was definitely a blue team.
It was
cheering Chelsea.
It was Red. It was definitely Liverpool because I'm wearing a skirtle. But
I did enjoy that line of no talking and no eye contact unless you want to get shot in the face, which is a lot like real people.
Much like Empire
real
issue meetings, quite frankly.
And then, of course, the bigger reveal later on in the film is that when Aldrich Killian says that, and we think he's just like the second in command, the guy who's he's actually the guy. He is the Mandarin.
Speaking of Aldrich Killian, who's yet another, for me, unpronounceable name. I did not like the way they did the cripple long hair stuff. I found that kind of tone a little weird. That was kind of
early Aldrich,
that cartoony limping thing wasn't to my taste. I also didn't like how Tony at one point uses the phrase to the kid Harley, "You had me spazzing out there."
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about zigzagging, also includes that tone. But I think when I first saw that first bit, when he was playing this, you know, limping character, I just went, "Oh no, what's this?" I'm not happy with that.
Well, it was too on the nose because he had like a cosmetic spot on his nose and he had lank, long, greasy hair and fake crooked teeth. It was like, all right, we get it.
You know? Exactly.
That was a little overcooked.
So Aldrich is the Mandarin. He kind of embodies that character. Yeah. I really liked that idea. It was kind of saying something about a figurehead. It doesn't matter about being the big bad guy. It kind of deconstructs that mythos of, hi, I'm the big evil bloke. Focus all your attention at me, which is amazing considering that we've got Thanos coming up, who is like the ultimate of that kind of character. It seems amazing. This seems like a real treat that we're watching a Marvel movie that can deconstruct that thing.
What did he want?
Yeah, this was exactly what I was going to ask. I think this is my only weak point is Killian's motivation, and indeed what he was doing wasn't clear to me, because at one point it seemed like that people were melting down accidentally and they were covering that up by saying they were terrorist attacks. This is what it seemed to me, that it was unintentional, these people, because he was saying that some people, a percentage of them, simply just reject extremists. That's something that happens. But then at the end, he's saying, well, I want to own both sides of the war on terror. But even that seems a little bit like he's cobbling it together as he goes along. There seemed an absence of a master plan.
I don't know. If you have if you've got a guy installed as the President of the United States of America and you control him...
Bless them for giving Miguel Ferrer work. I love that man.
Anything that gives Miguel Ferrer work is fantastic.
I felt that was very slipped in and tacked on, that vice president.
It felt like that. It felt like an afterthought a little bit, like an added thing to kind of make the plot make sense.
I think he wanted several things. He wanted power. He wanted revenge on Tony. And he, by and large, nearly succeeded. I thought Guy Pearce was fantastic.
He was very, very good. Yeah.
I thought he was
I liked his dragon
better.
Tattoos as well.
Yes.
The boy with the dragon tattoos.
Thank you. I really liked him in the role, and I thought he was a very credible villain, and you know, better than I would say than Mickey Rourke as Iron Whip or whatever.
Oh, yes. Well, he was crippled by the too many characters mess, I think, of the second one a little bit.
Not that the second one is dreadful. I mean, the second one's got a reputation over the last few years as being absolutely dreadful.
No, it's
dreadful.
Not dreadful
it's
at all.
It's fine.
Just, it has a weak third act. That's its issue.
Yeah.
I think one gamble that they took, which could have completely scuppered the movie and which I predict is going to be the thing that naysaying critics are going to pick up on, is the kid. Now, I think that they actually did this really, really well and managed to not make the kid incredibly cutesy and annoying, because he could easily have been incredibly cutesy and annoying. But I think that's going to be the thing that people criticise.
He was fun. Really? I think he served a device. You know, he was a narrative device. He also helped you sort of reflect on Tony's sort of vulnerable side. But the interplay between them worked, because Tony's so relentlessly unpleasant to him.
Yeah, well, your dad left. It happens. Get over it.
Yeah, I really
like
that.
You know, dads leave. Don't be a pussy about it.
Yeah. Exactly. His caustic comments. Really,
Tony doesn't talk down to kids. He doesn't care that he's talking to a 10-year-old. He'll just and I love the fact he gives him essentially, for kids, what would be a weapon of mass destruction just to use on a bully. I liked the relationship between Harley and Tony. I liked Drew Pearce and Shane Black said to me they didn't want it to be Spielbergian. They wanted to subvert that and sort of Frank Capra-ness of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I really, really liked the way they got on. And of course, he was integral in keeping Tony alive. There's a slight, I guess, you could say there's a slight contrivance that Savine and the other girl, Brandt, would be in Rose Hill, Tennessee.
Yes, that's quite random, isn't it? Requesting the file.
There's an idea about the file, which seems to me like, well, okay, why would they be at the same place as Tony? There's a file. They need to get a file, which is never talked about at the end.
It felt a little bit like there was either more to that scene that didn't make it into the film, or it was just an absolute afterthought. Who knows?
But again, a great example of how Tony survives on his wits in this movie. The stuff with the microwave oven.
Yeah, very good.
And Brandt.
Very good. That's full-on Katie Ryback right there.
It is. It's very, very cool indeed. And I whenever Stephanie Sostak, who is the French actress who stars as Brandt in the movie, whenever she was revealed in the trailer, people were going, is she the Wasp? Is she the Wasp? Is this a setup for Avengers 2? Well, no, she's not. She's dead.
That moment, sorry, that area when I think Tony calls your man Westworld, which
yes,
I really
yes,
enjoy.
Another good line.
There's lots of, I thought, Shane Black references there, or kind of hat tips. We had the bunch of Christmas trees.
There's the Last Boy Scout reference, obviously, when he's tied up and he's essentially the
it's a riff.
Touch me again, I'll kill you.
And this is from Drew Pearce or from Shane? We're guessing. We'll have to ask
them. Well, you'll ask them, but my feeling is, having spoken to them both, is that you know, Shane's movies are traditionally set at Christmas, but I think he was slightly reluctant to do so with Iron Man 3, and Drew Pearce pushed him in that direction and let Shane, I think, realise that he could Shane Black up this movie, this massive summer blockbuster, and actually bring some lovely personal touches to it. And I'm delighted that he did, because I think the banter between Rhodey and Tony towards the end is really, really funny and very redolent of, obviously, Damon Wayans and Bruce Willis, Last Boy Scout, or Gina Davis and Sam Jackson and Long Kiss Goodnight, or of course Riggs and Murtaugh in Lethal Weapon. So I love that stuff. I think they're both fantastic.
There are also little tiny moments, and I don't know where they came from, whether it was a Black thing, a Pierce thing, you know, just an Iron Man thing, involving his little cranes in the lab. I actually awed to see Dummy, you know, have a bad day when the house was attacked. I felt bad for the poor thing.
I want a Marvel one shot with Dummy.
Yes,
it's Dummy.
It's a Pixar short. Surely.
I think the two names are Dummy, you, and then it's Jarvis, obviously.
Yeah.
Is you one of them? It's like, hey, you. I think the other one's called you. People will write in and correct us, I'm sure. I want to see them have adventures. Jarvis and the two robots going off in some sort of 18-30. Cruise.
I love Jarvis in this. He actually got a chance to. He's always quite acerbic and funny, but he got a chance to actually just have funny situations.
Well, he had a character this time, which I don't think he's properly had
when
before.
When he said, I'm afraid the words at the end of my sentences are occasionally cranberry. And also when he says, I may be melt. I just felt like I love Jarvis for who he was, but you're right. There is a character there. He's actually a person. I would like Dummy and you, or whoever they're called, to have. I would like Jarvis to have his own suit. And like Jarvis to have a physical representation rather than just being his onboard computer.
Paul Bettany in body as well as voice.
Yeah, that's what I'd like.
I wonder if Paul Bettany's seen any of the movies by now. Last we heard, he hadn't.
Which I kind of love. What did people make of the Downton Abbey thing?
The Downton Abbey riff, I thought it was hilarious. I did think it was hilarious.
It's very big right now. Very hot.
Mm. Also, I'm a fan.
So. We know from your best friend, J.J. Abrams.
Ah, yes, my close personal friend, J.J. Abrams.
That he's a big fan.
He is. A very, very big fan. It's something of an export phenomenon, isn't it? But I love that it was a recurring joke for Happy in the film. I thought that was quite fun.
That's a very, very nice beat for Favreau at the end of the movie.
Yeah. When he's pointing,
is he
going
to do something profound? Is he? No.
He's trying to watch the telly.
I actually thought they were going to put in the spoiler from the Christmas episode this year, and that was going to be what he was trying to watch on TV.
That would be too much. This was set a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think one of the criticisms that people levelled at Iron Man 2 was that it largely functioned as a trailer for the Avengers and an introduction for Ali's just written Dummy on the.
Yes, because he's not Dummy, he's Dum-E, which I didn't know until this movie.
That's amazing.
Anyway, Dummy, as you were saying.
Okay, yes, anyway, is that Iron Man 2 functions as a trailer for the Avengers and Thor and Captain America, and I loved the fact that there was virtually none of that in this movie at all. There were no setups for Guardians of the Galaxy.
None at all. Which leads us a little bit to the post-credits sequence.
Yes.
Of which there is one, which has absolutely nothing to do with Avengers 2 whatsoever.
But it does have the ever-wonderful Ruffa Hulk.
It does. It doesn't do.
You lied to us.
Technically, there was no Hulk.
Yeah. There was Banner.
And it was just such a, I mean, like the shawarma, it was just such a throwaway gag. It was funny, it had no point to it whatsoever. Although, arguably, it does close the framed narrative, which otherwise, you know, has no context.
It does. The voiceover, you're going, who's he talking to? And again, it's a wonderfully Shane Black voiceover.
Yeah.
It calls back Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the unreliable narrator who is very aware he's telling a story and I'm going to take my own sweet time telling it, and you know, I love that touch. Yeah, and the thing about, I think there's a rule now for Marvel movies. If the post credit sting affects the wider plot of whatever phase you're in at that point, it will be just after the end credits, just as people are about to start and get.
Yeah.
And if it's just a funny thing,
they'll
that
bang it
just there for
right
the fans,
at the
like
end.
Shawarma or Banner turning up at the end of this movie. It's right at the end. It's a reward for people who stayed, and I really like that.
No bad thing.
Speaking of the credits, they had that wonderful sort of 70s homage superhero thing, which I thought was just spectacular, and the music that went through it was amazing.
By the way, Eiffel, Dabba Doo, Bleeda Bly, when they're going back to 1999, it's I'm Blue is the tune they pick.
Opening the movie, that was a bit of a
You've
shock.
You've got big balls if you're playing Eiffel, whatever it was, 95. With I'm Blue, that was extraordinary. But yes, back to what you're saying, the credits are spectacular. Anyway, that affected me more than other people.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I was there with you. Yeah,
I was like,
when the movie opened to Blue, you're just like, I can't believe I'm hearing this.
Is it the name of the song, or is it
the song's called I'm Blue?
Okay, so it's not Blue the band.
Like,
no,
Duncan Thingy and what's his face?
Yeah,
as they're technically known.
Your pop knowledge is astonishing.
You know, One Love for the Mother's Pride. You know that one, Blue. Yeah,
isn't that bread?
One Love for the Mark 42. No.
Anyway,
you're now freestyling.
Can we talk a little bit about the Tony Stark wannabe impersonator TV?
Gary,
yes. Big fan of Gary.
It went full Partridge there for a while, didn't it? That was quite terrifying.
Piss off, you're a mentalist.
You're a mentalist.
Tony needs Gary, and Gary needs Tony.
That was
Gary
funny.
Needs to shut up and get on with his job. I love that stuff. Fantastic. Again, one of those little quirks and risks that they were taking. I love that.
That scene could easily have been, wow, that's a little bit of easy plot, you know, Red Bull. Well, let's just get it going. He hacks into the computer, sees what's going on. Oh, all the videos have been taken. They'd explain everything that goes on. But you're too busy giggling from the fact that Gary's rocked up, pulls off his hat, and he has the beard. You go, of course. Yeah.
I love that line, the hair's not right because there's no product in it at the moment.
And then you find yourself staring at Tony's hair going, you're right, there is. You
know, Tony has good hair.
He does have good
but
hair.
Where did he get the product hair. From? I mean, he's got the Dora the Explorer watch, which I absolutely loved as
he
well.
He never has helmet hair.
Yeah, it's weird.
Never has helmet hair.
I guess that's part of being a superhero.
It's probably built into the suit, to be fair.
That's why he is Iron Man.
Yeah.
Well, he would actually build in a hairdryer, wouldn't
has
he?
Has product in a hairdryer. Yeah. Yeah.
Drips in from the top of the helmet.
Yeah. Excellent. I had a bit of an issue with Mia, I'll be honest.
Maya.
I had a bit of an issue with Maya, I'll be honest.
Mia. it's Maya.
It's Maya. Maya.
I'm keeping it in.
Yeah.
Fine. She just felt a bit... She felt like a collection of cliches, which maybe makes her not a cliche. But I feel like I've seen every single beat from her before, and she was the only thing or person in the film that I felt that way about. So, you know, the sort of the scorned lover... The sort of the attempted banter with him. The only thing maybe I hadn't seen from her was hanging out with the new girlfriend, which was, you know, potentially an interesting thing. But then she turned out to be, oh my goodness, treacherous. But then she turned out there was good in her after all. But and then she got killed.
I mean, that's fair from the comic line, isn't it? So, I mean, the reveal at the end of that is that she was part and parcel of the whole releasing
extremis. But again,
but she's not evil in the comic books.
No, she's misguided.
She does end up paying the ultimate price.
Yeah, going to prison.
£4.50. for her treachery and her evil ways. But in this one, yeah, and I kind of get what you mean. I thought Rebecca Hall was fine.
She was fine. I've no problem with her.
I just really liked
the character.
I really liked the fact they pulled the rug out from under us. You know, I'm going to kill myself. And then I don't care. And he just kills her anyway. And that was a really nice moment.
Shane Black, I thought.
Yeah. And again, it undercuts the movie for anyone who's read Extremis and knows where the movie is going or thinks they know where the movie is going. It's like, oh, Hank, what? That's not what should be happening right now. Hang on, if we just check page 37. Yeah, she's still alive. It's not quite right. So I really like that.
But this isn't a movie I think you can say that it doesn't empower women. Often superhero movies tend to just have them as squealing, oh no, I need to be rescued, I need a hero.
Well, actually, just this week, in fact, as we record this, two t-shirts have been released by Marvel Disney. One says it's for boys and it says be a hero and shows the Avengers, and the other one's for girls and says I need a hero and shows the Avengers. So, you know, there is still that attitude.
To be fair, I'm not sure I agree with you entirely on this. I think there's elements of her. I mean, she gets the armour on, but Tony puts it on her, and then at the end she goes full mental, and that's good. But
she goes full mental.
She goes full mental. She punches the shit out of old. She gets. Old
it's not rather mental aggressive. To attack a bad person.
No, I know. I'm just saying she okay. gets quite violent with him. But up until then, she's been relentlessly pathetic. I mean, she's lying on her back with her arms out, going, "Help me, help me." She is basically Penelope Pitstop. So yes, she does get a little bit of redemption at the end, but she's not the most, you know, she's not what I would call a feminist icon.
No, true.
But they do.
Well, I don't know.
Her.
She's a CEO at least. I think
she has a business head on her shoulders.
Pepper Potts could have been a nothing role, and I think over three films, four, I guess, with Avengers, they've done more with her than we've often seen from true. Similar characters in the past. That said, yes, I agree. There's a lot.
She's a CEO
of a
who goes
go.
A bit gooey when Guy Pearce comes up and stands near
well,
her.
Well, I mean, we've all been there, haven't we? Haven't we?
None of his dresses, Peter Weyland.
Fair enough.
You'd be a bit like, oh, what the hell is that? Get away from me.
Have you been in a coffin for 5 years? Yeah. That stinks. I'll give that 20 minutes. I did think that the fact that she actually saved the day was a lovely feeling.
Yes, that was nice.
She won the day. Tony had kind of semi-cocked up five times in a row, just through chance, basically. And if, I mean, what would have happened if his girlfriend hadn't fallen to her death, then come back to life, kind of? I mean, yeah. I'm glad that they had two moments to kill off Aldrich. I really enjoyed the second deathing.
The second deathing was the better of the two deathings.
I did enjoy that deathing. And I just found that final scene very satisfying when we see all the suits. Do we want to talk about the suits?
Yes. Because it's the first, obviously, tip to that is thing. It says Mark 42 on the arm of his armour, which is a bit like, oh, I'm sorry, what? Did I miss 40-odd films?
I hope that's a Douglas Adams reference. Carry on.
It could be. Which obviously we see at the end that he has been tinkering in his basement and has built another 40-odd suits, some of which have interesting names like Red Snapper. Others, I'm sure there's references. I'm sure a lot of those suits are slightly sort of arcane nods to Marvel lore. I know one, I thought one looked a bit like Ronin, the one that was sort of matte black with the gold trim on the edges. That may not be intentional.
I think at one point he dons the my favourite Iron Man armour over the years, the Silver Centurion, which he first did.
Yes, I think that one's in there.
I think he wears it at one point, but I couldn't really tell because the 3D glasses make the colour not quite as bright, so I need to see it again. But non-3D.
And then there's the big, stocky, what people are saying is the Hulkbuster armour, which looks like a Terminator Marine.
I don't think that's a Hulkbuster armour.
Well, no, the Hulkbuster armour traditionally he wears over his normal armour.
Yeah.
So it probably isn't, but it is quite.
There are but the idea online to see what they're called.
Yeah.
But the idea behind that is that Tony has this anxiety following the Battle of New York and essentially dying in the battle against the Chitauri. And in order to try and keep his mind occupied and stay away from that sort of the bad times coming back to haunt him, and also this idea that he wants to protect people, he just builds as many suits of as many shapes, sizes and colours and functions as he can possibly think of. And the movie heavily hints towards that. You know, there's... It's interesting because I first saw the 15 minutes of this movie when I was over in LA in January to talk to everybody for it, and they showed us 15 minutes, and there was the battle of, it was the destruction of Tony's house in Malibu. And there was a line in there at one point when the house is about to go down, it's about to explode, and there's a line where Tony basically says to Jarvis, are the others, and I'm paraphrasing here, but are the others okay? They say, are the other suits okay? And Jarvis goes, yes, they're fine, they're underground, they're locked away. He goes, okay, blow the suits. So so Tony takes the decision to blow up his Mark 1 to 8. So that's why we see at the beginning of the movie they're blowing up one at a time.
Yes.
Because Jarvis is doing it as part of a self-destruct sequence. And that sequence has been re-edited slightly now so that they blow up as a result of the Mandarin's attack and not Tony's choice. And the line about the suits has been taken out. So, but you could still, there are still little hints and clues that he's been building more than just... the odd suit of armor.
Yeah, because I did notice the line where he asks Jarvis, have the cranes arrived at the house? And Jarvis says yes, and you're kind of like, well, why is he really worrying about that right now? And of course it immediately becomes clear sort of 5-10 minutes later. But yeah, it's just slightly foreshadowed now and again.
Going back to the ending, there was an element of machina ex machina, that they opened up that vault just at the last moment, then all of the suits come out just at the right moment. But it's such an amazing sight to see these 40-odd suits just suddenly arrive in this kind of fleet that you don't really care.
Yeah, no, I really liked it.
It's a feel-good moment, isn't that?
It really is.
It's quite, you know, It's quite a nice
until one. It also addresses something that Ali, you were expressing concern about in advance of the movie, you know, because we've seen that there are lots of suits in the movie. We'd seen that in advance, and you were kind of concerned, how is this going to play out with Avengers 2 if we have 40 Iron Mans? You know, how is that going to... Iron Men. What threat is going to be big enough to require all of those plus the Avengers? And they've neatly dealt with that with two words, clean sweep.
Clean slate, yeah. Is it clean slate or clean sweep? Slate.
Either way, they all blow up.
Yeah, I just thought that was really, really neat. I like it. It makes sense within the context of their relationship that they'd have only just one suit. But now I think we can safely presume, disagree with me, that his next suit, which will be Mark Infinity Plus One, will also be a prehensile.
Yeah, you would think, right?
Yeah.
You would think. That'd be very interesting to see where they go with it, if indeed they go anywhere with it. They can't not go somewhere with this, can they?
Who knows?
Well, let's look at where Marvel are going then. So they've blocked out to what, 2015? Mm-hmm. So we're going to have 2013. We've got Thor: The Dark World coming up. Next year we have Captain America: The Winter Soldier. Then Guardians of the Galaxy, which is the biggest risk that they ever taken. And I'm intrigued to see what happens with that one. Then slightly safer, Avengers 2.
A lot safer, I'd say.
Which, yes, in 2015, May 2015, which could be the same month as Episode 7.
Best month ever.
And then November of that year, Edgar Wright's Ant-Man, which is another risk. I'm delighted to see they're kicking off Phase 3 with Ant-Man. So, next time we see Tony will be in 2015.
Probably,
but
yes.
Will we see him again in 2016? And if we see him again, will he still have the same face? Dun, 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 dun.
Or will they take his face off?
Maybe.
Who knows? Who knows? But it'll be interesting to see what happens in Iron Man 4. Helen, go. Brainstorm now.
Iron Man 4, right now. I think...
Too slow. Fire. Okay. James.
Trevor Slattery is Iron Man.
I have my money already.
Do we have anything else we want to talk about?
Just as we're rounding up, I can feel the interviews coming up shortly, so look forward to them. I just wanted to just list a couple of really amusing moments that I'm looking forward to seeing again. I love the Barrel of Monkeys stuff. Mm-hmm. That amused me.
That's great.
References to Ringo and Meryl Streep.
I like how he dispatches Savine in the Air Force One sequence.
Mm. Yeah.
What's the line? Grow that back, you son of a bitch, or something. It's something like that. I've only seen it once.
I really like the Don Cheadle moment when he comes flying out of the Iron Patriot armor.
He's been locked in there.
Smacks Savine in the face, and then obviously Killian sort of like incinerates the wall, and he just looks at him and goes, "Breathing fire, really?" And then basically just gives up.
Yeah, Cheadle's really good in this film.
Yeah, he's very good. He gets a lot of humor in it, which Cheadle actually does very well.
Yeah,
he's very likable, and his saving of the president, I thought, was a really nice Cheadle moment.
I thought that was great. The whole which led from that moment I was talking about, where he's cornered by the guy, the extremist soldiers, and how is he going to get out of this? And he engineers this incredible fireball escape, which is just fantastic. Yeah. I really, really loved that.
I also love that the president was smiling when he got out of the armor, like, "Yeah, this is really cool. I've had a really good time, even though I've just been, you know, snatched from
William
Air Force
Sadler
One itself."
Is awesome.
William Sadler is awesome. Is awesome, no question.
You may be a king or a lowly street sweeper, but sooner or later, you dance with the Reaper.
I think my favorite moment wasn't even that, though. It was incredible. It was War Machine rocks all caps
with an X.
With an X. That was incredible. Obviously, we will discuss the Slattery-isms, which were just.
Everything he said was gold. That was, I think, my favourite line was that his leer was the toast of Croydon. That's
yes. What was the line Savine says to him? Why didn't you press the panic button? Well, I thought about it, then I panicked. Something like that.
And then I dealt with it.
Yeah. What did you tell him? Pretty sure I told him nothing.
Yep, nothing.
I love the line where Tony's giving advice to Harley, the little kid, and he says, yeah, but I can get away with that. Otherwise, if you do it, it'll come off grandiose, and you don't want to do that. I also love that the car that evil henchman guy, who again I forgot the name of, drives, is of course an Audi, naturally.
Well, everybody drives, an Audi.
Yeah, it's product placement.
Yeah, the product placement remains in force. Burger King seems to have fallen by the wayside, but Audi's still there.
Yeah, although they trash a few of those. They were tumbling out of his house when it was being blown out.
Listen, you know, I drive an Audi. Audi, hello, Audi.
Can we all have free Audis?
Audi, please.
Yes. Yeah, Audi.
I could do with a new Audi.
I like seeing Tony Stark on a payphone, which I thought I'd never see. I mean, Tony Stark crying is one thing, but him on a payphone was bizarre.
Yes, but dialing a secure server inside a helmet as opposed to, you know, voicemail.
Mm-hmm. But we've also got the naughty girl line. You know, when he's in the suit, but not actually in the suit, and he's giving a back massage to Pepper Potts, and they went, "Oh, you've been a naughty girl." And I just go, "Where did that come from?" Anyway, I could go on and on. Gluten-free waffles was another great moment.
Yeah.
What have you eaten for breakfast? Well, no, the more I think about it, the more I enjoy this film. And yeah, I'm excited about meeting both Shane Black and Drew Pearce tomorrow.
But you mentioned the lines just quickly. This is it's too rare, I think, nowadays. You see truly great comedic dialogue in action films, and Avengers definitely has it, and this definitely has it. But I think it shows the absence of it in so many other films, a lot of the Marvel films. And you know, I'm hoping that this trend continues. I mean, obviously, Marvel helps when you have, you know, Shane Black and you've got Joss Whedon and stuff.
I think the fact that the directors of the Captain America movie are the Russo brothers, who are really, really funny, directed some of the best episodes of Community, that augurs well. Thor might be more serious, I'm guessing.
But then Thor was actually one of the funniest of
I think we're on a roll at the moment. I really do. I think I don't know if this movie is quite as enjoyable as the Avengers, but the fact is I want to watch it again pretty much instantly, which is the same reaction I had when I watched Kiss Kiss Bang Bang for the first time. So 2 for 2 for Mr. Shane Black as a director, I would say.
I want to read Tony Stark's autobiography, Cheap Trick and a Cheesy One-Liner.
Cheap Tricks and a Cheesy One-Liner, yeah.
That's the thing I immediately want to do after watching that film.
Very good.
Get on it. Okay, and now without any further to do, an interview with Mr. Drew Pearce and Mr. Shane Black, the writer and director of Iron Man 3, with Helen and Ali, because I'm not here. Boo.
Friends of mine who'd even seen the movie.
And we had not been told that anyone had seen the movie. So today, when everyone we talk to has seen the film, it's the first we've been introduced to any reaction whatsoever.
Yeah, and it's been terrifying. And it's a movie that we'll be able to talk about in this spoilerific podcast, has things to spoil in it. And so I'm kind of slightly shell-shocked from my ability to talk about something that's been a secret for 2 years and actually, you know, out loud speak about it with other human beings that aren't you or Kevin Feige.
I'm shell-shocked by the bizarreness of some of the questions that came from the journalists today.
Okay,
what's the weirdest?
The press conference questions were loose.
I think they were serving something with lunch.
They were esoteric. They were those kind of questions that is genuinely impossible to listen to the whole one. It's like
those one kind of them was like, if you could replace any part of your body with an iron part, what would it be? I mean,
that's red rag to a bull with Shane. It's like, don't ask him that in front of a room full of people.
What sort of, can you imagine like the New York Times going to President Obama saying, President Obama, if you could make your head into a pumpkin, would you? You know, I mean, why would you ask?
I wish they were yes no questions. For me, they're more like, I'm really bad at like directions from one place to another, and for me it's like listening to someone go, and then you go straight down Main Street and then you take a left onto Third, and by the end of it I'm like,
you can't
I don't
keep up with
the
their question
one.
Because I have a 3-part question first, and by the time they get 20 minutes later, the third part of the question,
and you figure jet lag into that, and frankly it's game over.
Well, I have a 5-part question here.
Exciting.
I mean, let's start, I guess, with the sort of the extremis thing, because I imagine that's the kind of issue you need to tackle early on. What is your bad guy going to be? What's he going to be doing? What's he going to want? What are his powers that are going to prove a genuine threat? You've got to settle all of that, I guess, quite early on in the proceedings. So how did you do it?
What did we toy with?
We kicked around a lot of stuff. I mean, both separately and together, Extremis and Mandarin are, you know, two of the iconic stories of Iron Man. But there's plenty of other stuff too. We talked a lot about the Five Nightmares as well.
In fact, the version of Extremis that ends up in the movie is suspiciously similar to the actual way the bomb people manifest in Five Nightmares. It's kind of a mashup, as it were.
And actually, with some of the early drafts, or at least our early writing, probably before it came into being as an official draft, we were actually toying even with the idea of the Five Nightmares idea of black market RTs and reactors, because the Matt Fraction run does a brilliant real life job of that. You know, we didn't go down that route in the end, but that's partly kind of how we were originally envisaging it.
Remember the Marvel version where Pepper Potts goes undercover at the black market bazaar in like Nairobi or something. I was like, that doesn't seem very realistic.
But there was one thing that's made me think of something. Do you remember? You know, we were talking earlier. This is a total aside, by the way. I don't know if this is allowed to be the rambliest, most jet-lagged podcast ever in history. But if it isn't going to be, it is now. Do you remember when I wrote that that sequence in the first draft for Pepper? We were trying to establish the idea of her as what happened to Pepper since the second movie. And we did like this little sequence that was like Otto from Inglourious Basterds, you know, the German guy, and they do that like mini Sam Jackson narrated exploitation update, and we did a whole like kind of rolling Tarantino-esque two-page. It was cool as well.
It's all cool, but the fact is, when we were introducing the characters, we had these collage kind of mini montage segments that would have made the movie 3 hours and 50 minutes long.
Which it actually was, even though we didn't even shoot them. So, So
that's, by the way, fun fact, although tragic fact, scary fact, is the movie came in as an assembly at 3 hours and 15 minutes. Yeah. Wow. And it's ended up being 159 something. We cut an hour and 15 minutes of footage. Picture sitting still for an hour and 15 minutes. That's a movie.
Mm. Yeah, we cut a movie.
We lost
a movie
out of the movie. And I don't know how he did it, and that's the miracle. It's always a leap of faith. I never would have believed we could cut it down and still have it make sense.
And every cut you do, you always... It's the same, actually, at the script stage as it is in the edit. Every version of the script or every cut of the movie that you do, you go, this is it. This is bare bones. We couldn't lose another page. We can't lose another frame from this edit. Right. And then other people watch it, or you live with it for a couple of days or a week, or in normal movie schedules, sometimes a month. In this movie schedule, you walk away for 3 minutes and then you come back and try and analyze it.
What was the hardest thing to see go? If you're cutting out an hour and a quarter.
God. Well, I still miss, I think I've mentioned it before, but I miss the car chase. That would have been a lot of fun. On a purely practical level, the first Iron Man car chase was one of the elements that stayed in the movie pretty late. I mean, like, we location scouted it, you know. I don't think it was ever totally pre-vised, but we definitely had some amazing, like, art kicking around for it somewhere in the depths that probably make its way into some kind of phase two photo book in 3 years' time. I'm trying to think of the other stuff.
The only thing that potentially I would miss is there's a scene where the water tower falls over and traps Tony, and he gets up. There's actually a character that was cut out of a bully that bullied young Harley. Oh, okay. And he comes back, and they meet him in town. And later, as they're about to leave, they realize he's been trapped under the water tower. And Tony's trying to save him and can't, and is getting desperate. And suddenly Harley surfaces, and the little kid has actually dived down and saved his own bully. And then they have to resuscitate him, and Tony takes the RT out of his chest to shock the kid back to life. And
that was in so late that, to be honest, I sometimes forget that it's gone. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it sometimes surprises me. But, I mean, that's the nature of this movie's been insane, because summer movies are always under the gun. When it comes to, sorry, here's the tea and biscuits arriving in order to
I love that you've got the whole transatlantic thing here. You're having tea, Shane's having coffee.
But he's trying to be English and have biscuits, and I'm trying to be LA and have a banana. Oh. But at some point I will break and have a biscuit.
So it's a beautiful kind of crossover.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I become doughy if I eat these biscuits.
Shane, if you ever become doughy, I just won't believe it. I'm trying to think of the other stuff it's weird. There's stuff we lost from the 3 hour 15 cut, and there's also stuff we lost in the writing.
Right.
I think everyone other than Shane and I, and probably Shane and I as well, have forgotten some of the stuff that was in there in those first two drafts. But there were two whole different sections. Do you remember the MIT geeks?
Yeah, Tony, instead of consulting this young kid, he went to this kind of weird...
it was like the Stark wing of...
Yeah, and there was a kind of a Asperger-esque kind of semi-hot young Asian chick, right?
Who was? I think you've brought the Asian in there yourself, but
sorry.
But no, it's good. You obviously had specific casting in mind that I never realized. But
there was two of them.
Yeah, there was two of them. That's right. And one of them was a fan, and one of them was basically that kind of brilliantly chippy kind of student that you get who, because they meet someone famous, thinks the best way to deal with them is like with like total aggression. But yeah, but there was that. I don't know if I necessarily say I missed that. It played, but I don't think there was any room for it in our Capra-esque second act.
No, and as it turns out, there was, you know, you could probably take a lot of the material we wrote and just forge it into a document that would significantly be, you know, another script entirely.
Yeah, it's weird. You actually could.
We had other villains. Remember Madden?
Shit.
And Krieger. Sorry. And
bleep me.
It's fine.
You know, we had villains. You know, before Killian, there was Krieger and Madden, and
even Edwin Cord was discussed.
Edwin Cord, yeah. So
actually, that's a significant one. Like early on, I mean, elements ended up transmuting into other stuff we did, but like we really kicked around the idea of doing a Madden Mask movie.
Pepper, in one draft, slept with Killian. Because he was so pheromonally enhanced with this Extremis that she couldn't resist him, and she was angry at Tony, so she sleeps with Killian, and then he makes a sex tape and broadcasts it.
Oh my
in
God.
Home Depot.
Yeah, I mean, and the weird thing is I was going to say that was never an actual draft, but it kind of was in...
It
was the
second? In the draft. It was second draft.
Second draft. Wow. Wow, that seems audacious even by our standards. But it was definitely groundbreaking. Brilliant points throughout the process where, because Shane has basically only ever written his own scripts in a weird way, like he's his own master, and because of that, he's always been his own master of language as well, and whatever color that he wants to bring to that language. And there were a couple of genuine points early on where I would go, I don't think we can say that. And you genuinely didn't believe me we couldn't say fuck in a PG-13 movie. He was like, well, I had a couple of fucks, mate. And I was like,
you can have one, right?
Our first cut didn't have one. Our first draft, it had a lot.
Well, just speaking of villains, I mean, we've got to ask about Trevor. Big leap from Marvel, from anything else, to sign off on that. So how'd that go?
They were very open to it.
Yeah, it's good. And that surprised us. I mean, I remember the meeting where we pitched it to them as well. And I think you and I almost had like backup plans, I think, because we didn't know if they'd go for it. And Kevin, you know, Kevin did what, you know, Kevin's best at, where he took a beat and he thought about it and, you know, in classic Kevin style went, that'd be cool. And then it was like full steam ahead. And I think there's a part of him that liked the challenge of having for want of a better word, a twist in one of their movies, like just because he hadn't done it before. So, you know, it's the whole movie's been marketed with, in support of a twist, and a twist that is, you know, in the most generous version, a brave reinterpretation of a canonical character, you know?
Yeah.
It's already a brave reinterpretation of a canonical character. And then turn it into something else that people go, you have raped this
man. Look, here's the thing. As we do this podcast before the premieres, before the movie is released, I am still absolutely on tenterhooks about whether Trevor Slattery is embraced or I'm lynched. And you point at me and go, lynch him.
We won't be lynched, because here's the thing. I'm more interested in a way. I don't usually care about critics, but I'm interested in the idea of some critics somewhere saying, well, they've chosen to do something rather interesting in a comic book movie, more than a couple fanboys going, I wanted space rings.
Until they kill you.
Yeah. So,
no, I agree. I mean, like, what we are shooting for with that in the smallest possible way is... We always talked about the idea it would be lovely if we could get some satire into the movie, essentially. And in our own small way, I'd like to think that it is at least I don't think it's a grand artistic comment, but I do think it's an interesting analysis of real-world news cycles and, you know, and how the Western world demonizes and creates opposition that can fund military power or
fund
political power.
Niche for America waiting to be fear-fed its daily dose, and the Mandarin supplies that much the way that Extremis supplies the dose that fills the niche in the human mind for self-improvement.
And that's how we always hope that those two ideas would join up. And again, it's like you don't hit that stuff really hard on the head in the movie. You kind of can't hit it too hard on the head. But that's definitely how, for us, Extremis and the Mandarin concept join up as well.
And just, I mean, casting Ben Kingsley, because there you're sort of, I mean, you're already using Marvel's reputation a little bit against itself, and you're kind of subverting that, you know, that reputation for fairly straightforward stories. But also, I mean, the fact that they've already cast all of these Oscar nominees, Oscar winners, whatever, you know, alarm bells don't go off when you cast Ben Kingsley, and he gets to surprise us by showing us his comic side instead of his thespian side.
Well, I don't know if Sir Ben believes me, but we genuinely had him in our minds for when we wrote it. We had, you know, Sexy Beast in our heads, and we also had, you know, we felt like if anyone was gonna nail, like, precisely taking the piss out of a certain kind of British lovey, then he would know how to do that.
Sir Ben, has a wonderful philosophy, which is that he thinks you take what's there, what's presented to you, you talk to the writer perhaps if you have some ideas, but basically once it's written down and it's time to shoot, you bring it to life.
He locks in. Yeah, he locks in and brings it to life.
Yeah, he doesn't think you have to do much except take what's there and find ways, even if you find it awkward, instead of going, this is awkward, I'm going to change it.
Yeah.
You say, that's my challenge, is to bring it to life.
And I think when there's an actual red flag in the scripts that Sir Ben is given, well, I can only speak for this occasion because it's the only time I've worked with him, but like, I feel like he felt comfortable enough with us that he would have come to us and gone, listen, old boy, I'm not sure I can make this one work. And actually what he did was just like run towards it at 100 miles an hour. And I mean, like, again, the tenterhooks about how it will be received is one thing, but the tenterhooks about whether an actor could even pull off that turn was actually the first fear. And I mean, it's one of those things. These movies are big and they morph, and you know, there's lots of elements of improv. There's lots of elements that, even if they're not improv, they're impromptu rewrites or all of those elements. But his stuff, the Trevor stuff, even Harley stuff to a degree, that is pretty close to what we had in our first draft.
Yeah.
Like, there's the gags come and go, like, there's, you know, in there's always, you know, great Robert suggestions and stuff. But, I mean, and it's partly because of the two actors in those scenes as well. You know, you're working with a kid and you're working with, you know, a stage actor.
Why Liverpool versus Chelsea?
See? It's Liverpool.
Yeah, someone said it's Armory.
Arsenal.
It's
Liverpool because Sir Ben did say he was being Liverpudlian, but there seems to have been some...
If he goes up at the end of all his sentences, is that Liverpudlian?
No, not really. I mean, like, I think Trevor is his own thing, frankly.
It works for Trevor. I just don't know that. Yeah.
It was going to be Arsenal because before I wandered off to America for a bit, I lived in Highbury. So that's who it was going to be. But now it's Liverpool.
Mm. And I'm guessing, Drew, you're the Downton Abbey fan?
No, it was Jon Favreau.
Jon was.
We wrote it as, look, you don't understand how big Downton is in the States.
It's bigger, I think, in the US now than it ever was in the UK.
To be honest, it's kind of faintly appalling when you're British and you're over there.
Because people I talk to in the UK say, you know, it's not that good.
I mean, look, hey, I know lots of people that love it. For me, it's a wee bit soapy. But I think there's a kind of gentrification porn to it that appeals, and actually, to be, you know, what what John did with it is not only does he love it himself, but he feels like there's this totally, you know, unexplored story, which there were more hints of in the gargantuan version of the movie, but where Happy basically has always been in love with Pepper as well. And in Happy's head, Happy as the servant stood aside to let the other lord take his woman. And that's why there's the specific clip that there is in the movie.
I'm curious, in the trailer we get to see a tattoo on the back of the Mandarin's neck, which is kind of a bullseye slash Captain America thing. Was that just a kind of a tease for those comic book nerds?
No, it was actually part of the design of the Mandarin, was that he's part of his cobbling together. It's the Captain America shield with an anarchy symbol in the middle of it. It's a corruption of America again.
It's that brilliant kind of, again, it's the kind of mashup vibe of how would a think tank create a terrorist, and the way they would do it in their own wanky way is they would, you know, they would put together a mood board of all of the the symbols of modern Western power. And I think post the Battle of New York, Cap's shield would be one of them.
And graffiti is also big in the Mandarin's world, and the kind of graffiti art, it's anarchy. So part of what frightens people is chaos and graffiti and things like that. Mm. Anarchy and chaos are endemic to the Mandarin.
And I think we get to have our cake and eat it then, because there's also the aspect of graffiti art being endemic of the Mandarin could be perceived as kind of like a slightly old-fashioned notion. And so the idea that we get to use it for the Mandarin, but then also go, that was the think tank's idea. And I think it was kind of mind-bending sometimes, just trying to... It's easier when you've got the actor in front of you, but in the earlier drafts, trying to kind of balance what the Mandarin had to work as on a fundamental level pre-reveal and what he becomes it took some juggling.
When I first came to this movie, I was nervous about it. I was scared because of the number of suits. I went, well, if they've all got these suits that can just come in, well, how's that going to work for Avengers 2? Well, why have the Avengers just have Tony and his metal friends? I thought the clean slate initiative was a stroke of genius at the end. Whose idea was that? And was that something suggested by maybe Kevin in terms of making sure that there isn't too much power?
No, that was not Kevin. That was Drew said at the end, you know, I think that if he's going to prove to Pepper, in the version of the first draft, she didn't want to give up her powers. She said, I can't do it. I can't go back. And he said, well, how about if I give it up then? Mm. Will you do that for me? And he had the scene, which was very romantic, where he sacrifices the suits in order to get her to give up her power. So...
Yeah, and that was where it started. And I think, you know, it came to mean something else. I mean, like the key word in the later versions and in the filmed versions is this idea of distractions, and the fact that, you know, literally physically Iron Man has been getting in the way of their relationship.
Well, what it is really is, will you give up the other woman?
Yeah.
You know, I can't stop, you know, shtipping this other woman. Well,
or this other man.
Or this other, yeah. And she says, please. And he goes, okay, I'm going to stop just for you. And then she hugs him and says, thank you.
Yeah.
Which, you know, try that with an actual woman. Doesn't work.
I wouldn't even dare. And obviously the irony being that he will almost certainly go back on it and next time we see him. If I was a betting man.
But it was nice to see some kind of growth and change from
and I think the whole thing is, you know, it's a grand example of it's the thought that counts. So even if he has to build another one at some point down the road, A, it won't necessarily be our problem, and B, we feel like kind of we made one of the bigger points we wanted to with the movie, which was that, you know, that he is a hero now outside of the suit, and he can feel like a hero outside of the suit.
By that time, we'll be clear of this. We'll have our big residual checks, our back-end points. We can go buy some...
we'll have bought a little retirement home together in Florida.
We can go buy basically a balloon and a cookie.
And a handful of cents. Yeah.
Thank you very, very much.
We only just got started bullshitting.
I know. Listen, honestly, I'm only halfway through my list. But yeah, thanks very much.
And that was it. I'm sure they said some great things, and I enjoyed listening to them. How were they, guys? How were they?
How will they have been?
How
Chris?
Will they have been?
They will have been very entertaining, I'm sure.
Excellent. I'm so glad that you enjoyed that. And thanks for listening to this super special Iron Man 3 super spoiler podcast. The next one coming up, I guess, will be Star Trek Into Darkness. So join us in a couple of weeks for that. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Pod bye from Helen.
Bye bye.
Pod bye from James.
I am Iron Man.
No, you're not. Pod bye from Ali. Oh, hang on, are you?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Pod bye from Ali.
I am Tony Terran. bye.
And pod bye from me. I would not come into this booth for at least another 20 minutes.
Oh.
Bye.